Joshua, Judges chapter 7, continuing in the same series that Lee was speaking into. When I come to churches, when it's possible for me to just speak right into the series that the church is in, I always prefer that. So it's a joy to be able to speak out of Judges chapter 7. Like Sharon, I'm so grateful to be here. I'm so grateful for your partnership in the gospel, what God is doing, praying with us for the greater work of his kingdom in eastern Pennsylvania. Big challenges, as you can imagine. There's a, you could almost call it a spirit. So that could either be that there is a demonic spirit, or just there's a tendency, an atmosphere, not just in eastern Pennsylvania, but throughout the United States, that makes it very difficult right now. Actually, when I put on a mask and walk into a place, I do it because I love people, and I travel around and I visit so many different places, and if there ever could be an asymptomatic carrier, I could be the one. But it's interesting, you walk into a place with a mask on and here in eastern Pennsylvania, and depending on where you are, you can get a pretty cold reception, because that in itself is so representative. And by the way, I never received that here. But that can be so representative of what's happening in our nation right now. So we really need to pray. If ever there was a time that we have a unique opportunity to be salt and light, you know, the salt seasons things. Salt changes the flavor. Light comes in where it's darkness and people are stumbling around. If ever there could be a time that the Church of Jesus Christ could be that, now is that time. But we need a lot of prayer, because as difficult as it is for people outside the church, it's difficult for us as well. And I agree with what James prayed. I mean, often we don't even know what we're doing. You know, we're just trying our best. So thank you for your partnership. Thank you for even working on your own heart so that you can be people of faith walking through this. It means more than you probably realize. So thank you so much for what you're doing. I want to read the text. I just chose yesterday to read this before I told James I was not going to read it. So sorry about that. We're not going to have it on the screen. But if you would grab a Bible, and I will read from verse 1 to verse 22. And then I'll just be unpacking the story a little bit and bringing some application to us. Judges chapter 7, starting with verse 1. And again, we'll read all the way through verse 22. Then Zerubbabel, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the spring of Herod. And the camp of Midian was north of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. If you were here last week or whenever it was that Lee preached on chapter 6, you know chapter 6 was the introduction to Gideon, who this guy is. He was a fearful person, kind of a bad attitude kind of person, and God called him a valiant warrior and selected him as the chosen one. And Gideon, like, what are you talking about? Why me? Full of doubt, and then the whole thing about the fleece, you know, looking, testing to make sure that God really was calling him into this. So now he's ready. He's going to step into battle. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" If you want to underline a verse, that's going to be a key verse for us today. I entitled this sermon, the Blessing of Poverty, or the Blessing of Weakness, the Blessing of Being Unable, and that verse kind of represents that. Verse 3, "Now therefore proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead.' Then 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained." So Gideon had put out the call in chapter 6, "Come and help." 32,000 people stepped up to the plate, ready to engage in this battle against probably at least 135,000. You'll see that in chapter 8. And so they're ready to go, and immediately God, in his unique way, says, "All right, let's get rid of 22,000 of those people." I'm sure you know this story. Verse 4, "And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many.'" If ever you're kind of wondering, like, do I really want to hear God's voice? Do I want God to speak to me? Do I really want God to direct my life? This would be an example when you say, "Please, God, enough." Okay? Like, you're getting carried away here, God. You're taking away our strength. You're putting us in a place of poverty. Enough already. The Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And anyone of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, shall go with you. And anyone of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, shall not go. No compromise, like God's going to give the test. God's going to make the choice. Verse 5, so he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set by himself. They put their face in the water, and they lap it up, okay? Everyone that does that, you'll set them aside. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink, and the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouth, was 300 men. They drank like this. But the rest of the people knelt down, put their face in the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hand and let all the others go, every man to his home. So the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, but retained the 300 men, and the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. That same night, the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down, remember, one of the tests was, if you're afraid, go home. Look, he says the same thing to Gideon. If you're afraid, you can just go ahead and go into battle, but that's option one. Go ahead and go into battle if you're good. But option two, if you're afraid, I've got something for you. Gideon chooses option two. Actually, Gideon should have been one of those that went home. If that's a statement about leadership, you think leaders have to be like rise above it. Gideon was one of the afraid ones. But if you're afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. Again, like I said earlier, you see in chapter 8, at least 135,000 people. Verse 13, when Gideon came, behold, a man was telling a dream to his comrade, and he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it, so that it fell and turned it upside down, so that the tent lay flat. And his comrade answered, this is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp. As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshiped. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hands. And he divided the 300 men into three companies, put trumpets into their hands, and all of them an empty jar with torches inside the jars. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, and I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of the camp and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, when they had just set the watch, and they blew the trumpets, smashed the jars that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. Every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. They cried out and fled. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. And the army fled as far as Bethshitta towards Zerah, as far as the border of Abel Meloha by Tabith. Let's just pause there. So Lord, help us as we look into this text today. I pray that you would give us grace. We set the table, you provide the food. So come, by your Spirit, speak to your church because you love her. In Jesus' name, amen. I want to give you a backdrop for this story. It's really the backdrop for all of Judges. It's found in chapter 17, verse 6, and chapter 21, verse 25. It's repeated twice. It says it this way: in those days there was no king. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That's the context for it. The story of Judges is a story of people that don't have clear leadership over them, and as a result of a lack of leadership, they simply do what is right in their own eyes. I'd like to ask you the question, what does it mean to do what's right in your own eyes? Because obviously, it's a serious evil. I want that to be like sink into your heads, to do what is right in your own eyes is a serious evil. And without fail, the people of God doing what's right in their own eyes always end up enslaved. Always they lose freedom. Always they live out something other than God's purposes for their life. And if you ask why, the answer is because they were doing what was right in their own eyes. So we probably better understand what it means to do what's right in our own eyes. It's so significant because, you know, people inside the church, we tend to have this like pattern that we face outward. And we read the news and we look at our community and we point the finger and we say, look at all of the evil out there. And we call what we see evil and we say, that's what's really the problem, is the evil out there. It's so interesting. God doesn't think that way. Now, I'm not saying that God would not agree that there is evil out there, but he doesn't say that. He looks at the evil in here. Yes, sir. That's what concerns him. It's not the evil out there among those who are not his people that troubles God. It's the evil among the people of God that are his people, that carry his name, that do his bidding. Of course, people in our culture are not going to do God's bidding. They're not God's people. We're the ones called by his name. We're the ones that reflect his character or not. He's concerned about the evil within, not the evil without. Again, that's overstated. Of course, he's concerned about the evil out there. But he's primarily concerned about the evil within. And here he gives a name to it. He says that the name of the evil is they do whatever is right in their own eyes. Yikes. Now just think about that. What does it mean to do what's right in your own eyes? That clearly that tendency still exists. I mean, to do what's right in your own eyes is to be guided by like, well, this is the way I would do it. How many times do we simply get upset because somebody's doing something in a way other than what we would have done? I mean, again, I'm not going to meddle with you, and I have no history on your church. I mean, I do have some history in your church, but this is not like representing Lee or the board or anybody. I'm just kind of making these things up because I do know church, okay? I travel around, I do know church. So if you're at all like any other church, these are things that probably happen here, right? So to do things that like what's right in your own eyes would be like, well, I'll do it like my way, or I'll simply give it my best shot. To do it what's right in my own eyes is I'll figure out what I can do and I'll just use the wisdom that I have. For some of us, there's this tendency that we always want to be at our best. We always want to present what is our best, like put forward the our best effort, seen for all that I can be at the top of my game. So I do the things I can do and I avoid the things I can't do. I know my strengths, I live within my strengths, and I avoid my weaknesses, and I try to stay out of those. So when an opportunity comes to do something, I go, yeah, I'm sorry, I just don't do those kind of things. That's for somebody else. Friends, that's what it means to do what's right in your own eyes. What's natural, what I'm comfortable with. It's interesting, in 2 Corinthians 1, it calls God the God of all comfort. But we have another God called comfort. And it's not God. It's the comfort God, which says, I'll only do what I feel comfortable doing. I remember when I pastored a church, and you know how the worship wars happened. I don't know if they ever happened here in this part of York County, but the worship wars was like the transition from only using hymns to then using something else. And so our church, you know, all churches all over the place went through that. And I'm not going to make any statement about any of that. But in the middle of that, I remember one guy, he said to me, I'll never raise my hands. He didn't say, here's my biblical perspective on why I won't do that. And I'm not going to even try to quote any verses. I'm just telling you, Nate, I'll never raise my hands. Scott, why won't you ever raise your hands? Guess what his answer was? I'm just not comfortable with that. Well, like, if the Bible teaches it, or if it honors God, would you move beyond your comfort zone to do something that honors God? No, I'll never do that. It was interesting. I did catch him twice raising his hands. At a Promise Keepers event, you remember those in the late 90s? He went to a Promise Keepers event, and someone elbowed me and said, look behind you. So I took my camera and held it up, took a picture of him, and there was Scott with his arms up. I said, gotcha, gotcha, you do it. Here's interesting. You know the other time I caught him with his arms up? We were at a wedding. And there was the brother of the bride was a veteran. And this was during the Iraq War days. And so they wanted to honor this veteran who couldn't be present because he was serving overseas, which is, you know, it's a great thing to do. But in that honoring him, the band played I'm Proud to Be an American, where at least I know I'm free. Guess where Scott's hands were? I was so offended. I was so offended that he would raise his hands for a flag. I'm not making any political statement here, okay? But he would raise his hands for a flag, but he refused to raise his hands for his Savior. All because what I'm comfortable with. Doing things according to what's right in my own eyes. That, my friend, is the background for Judges. Please don't read into the book of Judges that these were like evil people, like the evil people out there. The evil of God's people in the book of Judges is very similar to our evil. That we love to be in control. We love doing things our way. We love to presenting what's best about us. And we want to avoid certain things as if they were the plague because we just would never naturally choose them on our own. That's the backdrop of this story. So you see that lived out here in chapter 7. Gideon is called by God. He knows he's going to go into battle, and God's going to test Gideon to see if he's going to do things according to what's right in God's eyes or if he's going to do what's right in his eyes. So we come into chapter 7, and the context is there's a real enemy. There is real danger. This is not pretend. If they lose this battle, they will die. The way they did war back then was not polite in any way. Their wives would be killed. Their children would be killed. Their land would be taken. Ethnic cleansing was the way to do it. And there are at least 130,000 people that are against them. It is in that context where we do what seems right in our own eyes, right? Where danger arises, where crisis arises, it's just natural for us to go into a fix-it mode. How can I make this go away? We become reactive. We run around trying to make the problem go away. We do what everybody would do. That's the problem. So Gideon does what generals would do. He rallies the troop, and the most he can come up with is 32,000 people. So he thinks, hey, this seems right in my eyes. Let's get 30,000 people. And this is where God articulates his point. I'm not going to let you go into this battle doing things what's right in your own eyes. I'm just not going to do that. I will not participate in that, God says. You're going to have to get rid of some of these people. Otherwise, when it's all done, you will conclude you made it through in your own strength. God really likes to set people up so that they know they cannot function in their own strength. In fact, God himself will arm himself with strength against our strength so that we know it's only by God's strength that things get done. You could say it this way: God really likes us weak. So there's the key. If you do what's right in your own eyes and you pull it off, it's something you can boast about. And the truth is, whoever gets to boast gets the glory. Let me say that again. Whoever gets to boast gets the glory. So this is not a story about how to select the Rangers, the Army Rangers, for your battle. This is not a story about that. This is not some kind of strategy to find the Navy SEALs, you know, the few, the proud, that can get the job done. And even those thousands go away, you've got really the 300 best. This isn't a story about whittling down the numbers so that you have this really great remnant left of the really good people. This is not that story. This is not about how 300 really brave people can do more than 32,000 people. That's not what this story is about. This is simply God drilling something into our heads. God seems to repeatedly place us in situations where we don't have the resources to pull it off, and we can't rely on ourselves. So when you get into the call to send home those who are fearful and trembling, the point of the story isn't be brave. That's not the point. Gideon himself is not brave. And when you get down to the point where either they're lapping or they're drinking, there's not something strategic in there. The point is simple. God wanted them to get down to a number that represented inadequacy. God wanted the ratio to be against them, not for them. It's huge for God. It's all about absolute, desperate dependency. It's all about reliance. If this is a story about God teaching us not to do things our way or not to do what's right in our eyes, you could say God's ways highlight his capacity, not ours. There's something else I want to pull out for you in this text. It really comes in that part of the story, verses 9 to 15. And I'd say it this way: God's ways highlight our dependency on his mercy and his instructions. If ever there was someone disqualified By the way, that whole thing of when the army gathers and you say to the people gathered, are there any fearful here? If so, go away. Do you know that simply was in the law in Deuteronomy? Every time Israel went into battle, they were supposed to ask that question. There was like two or three questions. One was, did any of you just get married? Yeah, go home. Like, and it says, go home and make your wife happy. It says that. Every wife should go, yeah. Like, go home and make your wife happy. It would be sad for you to die in war. So if you just got married, go, did any of you just bought a piece of property and you haven't planted on it? Yeah, yeah. Well, go home, plant that field. This is in the law in Deuteronomy. And the other was, are any of you afraid? If you're afraid, just go ahead and go home. Now, we're not down on you. It's natural to be fearful. But the truth is, we don't want that spreading around us. So just go ahead, go on home. That was in the law. So if there is anybody disqualified to enter into that situation, to enter into a situation where you're disqualified to enter, you're in it because of mercy. Right? If there's ever a situation where you're disqualified to be in that situation, yet God has you in that situation, you're in it because of mercy. Gideon is an example of mercy. God says to him, are you still afraid, Gideon? If you're afraid, I feel mercy towards you. God wasn't down on him. God wasn't ready to throw him out. God doesn't have a three strikes, you're out policy. It's grace upon grace, upon grace, upon grace, upon grace, upon grace, until you get to the point where you say, will you never give up on me? And he says, ah, now you're starting to get it. That's what your God is like, mercy upon mercy. God's ways highlight our dependency on his mercy. And in his feebleness, God says to him, my child, you're fearful. I want you to hear my voice through a dream. And I'm going to send you down there to hear this dream that I placed in somebody. The whole point is that God, in his mercy, wanted to bring revelation to Gideon so that Gideon would be dependent on the voice of God. Whenever we move into a situation and we are more ruled by what he says than by what we think, we're moving correctly. Whenever we walk into a situation and we say, well, maybe I'll find a verse that supports my position on this, but really I'm doing what's right in my own eyes and I'm hoping that God's okay with it, we're living out judges. God's ways repeatedly bring us to a place where we're dependent on his mercy and his instructions. And all of that, my friends, opposes just doing what's right in our own eyes. Last thing I want to see out of this text is, though if you go into chapter 8 and you see the Israelites do rally around Gideon, there's more than 300 involved in the battle when it's all done. It's not just the 300 that do it. Really, the rest are doing the cleanup job. Because verse 22 says, who really wins the battle? God does. Because he, through the whole trumpet and light thing, he sparks fear among the enemy, so they actually strike down themselves. It says in chapter 8 that 120,000 lay slain by the sword. That was their own sword that killed each other. Again, the point is, it's not because Gideon had a fallback plan and he rallied thousands of people to come back on the scene. God did it. God does things in a way so that when it's all done, we all say, God did that. That's what God's about. Now, let me wrap this up with this. I like to ask the question, why? Whenever I read something in the Bible and I go, wow, that seems unusual to me. That just doesn't seem like the way I would do things. I like to say, well, why does God do things that way? So two verses that I want to bring to you that give kind of a why about why God does this. The first is this, 1 Corinthians 1, 27 through 29. Listen to this. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. Same teaching in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 11, talking about spiritual gifts. It says, whoever serves should serve as one who serves by the strength that God supplies. Now, the reason God wants us to only serve with the strength that God supplies is in the next phrase. It says, in order that in everything God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. In other words, like I said earlier, the one who boasts gets the glory. You could say it this way, the one who provides the strength gets the glory. God's highest priority in any given situation is his own exaltation. In any situation, if you say, what is God doing? God is shooting for a wow. He wants to work in a way that people would stand back and say, that was all God. Wow. God lives so that he would be glorified, that he would be seen as the greatest, the kindest, the most influential, the most powerful. Now, I'm sure for some of you say, wow, that seems odd that what God would be into his own self-exaltation. Isn't self-exaltation a sin? Well, it is for everybody else except for God. Do you know why? Because self-exaltation is evil, because I'm putting myself above everybody else as if I'm the highest. But when God self-exalts, there is none higher than him. He's simply putting down into their proper place those that are under him so that he is seen as holy, as separate, as above, as holy in his goodness, holy in his love, holy in his mercy, holy in his power, holy in his wisdom, holy in his ways, in every way exalted above all. Because when we see God like that, we live best. The most gracious thing God can do for you in any moment is for him to exalt himself and to put you in your place. The most gracious thing God could ever do is to bring a church to its place where it says, oh God, not according to what's right in our own eyes. Oh God, please, not what's right in our own eyes, please have mercy on us. Not what's right, not my idea, God, not my plans, not my ways, not my strength. God, your ways. And I'm passionate about that when we come to that place because we know God's that smart, that good, that wise, that powerful, that capable. When he brings us to that place, it's the most gracious thing that he could ever do for us. Because now we're in sync. We're in sync with the God of the universe. This touches on something really deep in us, friends. I'm praying that we would be aware of this. This touches on our worldview. This touches on the lens that we use pretty much in every decision of our life. I mean, we do what's right in our own eyes. That's just natural. You got a problem, and the first thing, especially if, I hope this isn't a sexist statement, especially if you're a man, the first thing you do when you see a problem is, I'm going to fix that. I'm going to fix that. I know a solution. You know what I do? I try solution one. If it doesn't work, I try solution two. If it doesn't work, I try solution number three. If that nail's not going to go in, I'm going to get a bigger hammer. I mean, I'm just going to figure out a way to get her done. That's what's natural to us. What the Bible teaches us is contrary to that. You see, the very core of the gospel, which is the center of our life, is that from the beginning of our walk with Jesus until the end, We can't fix anything, save anything. We can't do anything by our own efforts. We can't do anything by our own efforts. I'll say it a third time. We can't do anything by our own efforts. And all I'm doing is paraphrasing Jesus' statement when he says, apart from me, you can get by. Is that what he says? Apart from me, you can hold it together. Apart from me, you can survive. You see the dependency he's trying to get into us when he says, apart from me, you can do nothing. The flesh profits nothing. Nothing. God is committed to us recognizing our weakness and our dependency. You know what that looks like? I've got the joy of walking through your remodeling effort over here. I'm going to tell you how I'm imagining that all happened. I'm imagining that it did not happen by you as a church saying, yeah, we can pull that off. That's doable for us. Yeah, we'll get it done. Yeah, I'm imagining you said, yeah, we know God's calling us to do it, but we can't do it. Even financially, like we can't pull it up. Ah, you were in your sweet spot. Did you know that? In the project, you were in your sweet spot when you said, we can't do it. And then you probably had some volunteers that showed up. And those that were really skilled at some of that labor, I'm guessing they did not show up like this. Oh, this is my sweet spot. I'm really good at this. Like, I can handle this and, like, get out of my way. Like, I'll just kind of do this on my own and stop bothering me. I'm pretty sure that did not happen. I'm pretty much sure that the way it happened is volunteers stepped in there and said, you know what, whatever skills I have, they're gifts from God, and I'd like to share those with others, and I'd like to teach some other people to do the same thing that I do. Even if there's some bad cuts along the way, it's going to be okay. You see the humble dependency? Whatever strength I do have, it comes from God. And if I don't have the strength, God can provide it. That's how it works. And I could tell you story after story, and I don't want to belabor this, but in the church that we served in New Jersey, we started to get this vision over time. And so we would start doing ministry in the summer to Vineland. Is a pretty broken community where we lived, a lot of poverty, a lot of like urban reality in a smaller city, and gangs and violence and death and drugs. And my wife and I chose to move onto a street that two doors down from us was a drug prostitute house. I mean, the police were showing there up there all the time. And we moved on that street, you know, with one purpose? Because we knew how to fix that street, and if we brought our strength, we could make everything better, right? Wrong. No, we moved in because it'd be a place of dependency, a place of brokenness. God, if you're going to do anything on Fenimore Street, you're going to have to do it. Our small group started to meet there. We started to do labor of love for our community. By the end, I don't know, 3-4 people got baptized on our street. People said they'd never come to church, came to church. A Jewish man that later on, I think, fell away from Christ, but he committed his life to Christ in the middle of all that. Just amazing stuff. And if you would say, Nate, could you write a book on how to do that? I said, what are you talking about? Like, we didn't know what we were doing. We step into situations that require God. And God's power goes to that spot like air to a vacuum. He rushes in because it makes much of him and little of us. We did summer ministry where we would reach out in those communities. We send children all over the place. We ended up like where we would have like hundreds of kids that would come to our camps, and we'd have like 60, 70 junior and senior high volunteers. We had people move from other states to come and be interns with us, and we funded the whole thing by faith. We never had a budget for it. I mean, we had a budget. We just never had income. And we would enter into the summer and say, Jesus, we're just trusting you for this. Now you say, isn't that a little bit foolish? There's more to the story. I mean, there's more. So we didn't put ourselves into financial jeopardy. But the truth is, all of that work, if God didn't provide, we just told all those interns, sorry, we can't pay for you. Do you know what? Year after year, God provided. I remember the last year that we were involved in, over $70,000 was given towards that project. That started to explode in our church, where people would say, why can't we do this year round? People like moved onto farms and dedicated all of their acreage so that volunteers would come and do the farming so that all the produce would be given away to the needy. I mean, the newspaper wrote articles about our farm. Another one said, like, there are needy people in our community. They'll never come to church. Why don't we go to them? So we started canceling our services twice a year, and we would mobilize everybody in the church just to go out and be in the community and love on people. And you, of course, you know what the board would say. You can't cancel your services twice a year. What's going to happen with the offerings? Like, you're just, like, you're getting rid of 250ths of your income. Yeah. 250 seconds, I don't know. Our budget never lacked. And we mobilized people, hundreds of people all over the city. Friends, it's a different way to think when you don't say what's right in our own eyes. And again, it doesn't mean you do things foolishly or you don't plan. You think it through, but the bottom line is, oh God, help us. I'll close with this. You know what my favorite prayer is? I'm one of those guys that, I don't say this to boast, I just think I pray pretty much all the time. I mean, if you were in my head all night long, I'm just, but you know what my favorite prayer is? You know what the prayer is that's going on all the time? It's two words, oh God. And it sounds like this, oh God, oh God, oh God. Oh God, you put yourself in a place of dependency and you cry. Oh God, help me. Oh God, help me. I was just talking with Mrs. Muir. Crystal? Nope. Claire. Her husband was a district superintendent. I said, Claire, you know what it's like for me to come back from vacation and I feel this overwhelming weight on my shoulders. And my prayer all the time is, oh God. I'm praying for revival in eastern Pennsylvania. I can't do that. A spiritual awakening where literally thousands of people would be ushered into the kingdom, where millions of dollars would be sent overseas, a deeper life movement of people that truly love Jesus with all their heart would be the fire, the kindling for mission that's happening everywhere. I long for that. I pray for that. And I don't have 1 ounce of strength to make it happen. And God says, I like that about you, Nate. You're willing to put yourself into your sweet spot where my constant prayer is, oh God, oh God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come. If you do not build the house, those who labor, labor in vain. I pray for Valley View Alliance Church that you would grant by mercy that this would be a church rooted in the opposite direction.